Blair Palmer, and welcome to the Punks in Suits podcast, bringing the leadership thinking, beliefs, philosophies, and practices behind punky, startup-y, next-stage businesses to you, even if your company's not quite there yet. Hello, and welcome to episode 15 of the Punks in Suits podcast. I hope you are very well. This week I've been really working hard on my book. I got a lot of encouragement last week. I gave a couple of speeches in France about Punks in Suits, and there was a lot of people talking to me and saying, I can't wait for the book to come out. And I was feeling kind of guilty because I haven't actually sat down with it for a number of weeks. So this week I've dedicated the whole week to getting back into it, and I'm feeling really good about it. And the topic that I have been writing about over the last day is trust. Now, you know that in last week's episode, I talked about some of the most recent data about trust, which is quite disturbing, and talked about businesses' responsibility in addressing this crisis in trust that we have in our world. I'm not going to take exactly the same tack today because I want to look at it much more from a personal perspective. And in particular, I want to talk about feelings. Now, don't freak out when I talk about feelings. I'm not suggesting that the workplace becomes a spiritual retreat where we all go each day to find ourselves. It's not that. It is a place that is dedicated to producing things that the customer needs or the customer wants and making money out of doing that, of course. But the business is more than just a machine. It is a living organism. When we think of a business as a machine and we think about cogs and wheels and efficiency and productivity and systems and processes, there is no room for talking about feelings, for emotions, in fact, of any kind. Of course, the truth is that emotions are there, very much there in the workplace all the time. A couple of years ago, I was working with a senior team on a restructure that they were doing. And we had some specialists come in to help them to work through a scientific process of figuring out what the right structure was for their organization. They wanted to be much more aligned with their internal customers in the way that they were organized. And they created various criteria by which they would measure whether certain models came up to the mark, whether they met the criteria or not. And as we went through the process over a couple of days, it became very clear that there was a front runner. And in the end, this particular option was really the only one that met most of the criteria that the team had said were absolutely critical. Funnily enough, I had been talking to the team, in addition to going through this scientific process with some colleagues, I had been talking to them about emotion and how we're aware of a percentage of what we think, but not everything that we think. But feelings, emotion, gives us a clue as to our thinking. And one person in the team had rejected this notion and said, look, I've been working as a professional person for more than 30 years. I've become really skilled at leaving my emotions at the door when I come in. I make decisions based on the data, based on logic, not on my emotions. So after some conversation, I decided to let it go and see how things would play out with this restructure process that we were going through. So we got to the point where there was one option left. It was clearly the only one that met the majority of the criteria that the team had identified. And everyone except for this one individual knew that this was the only option for their organization going forward. But this one individual was very resistant. And the team rallied round and tried to understand what it was about this option that made it a deal breaker for him. But there really didn't seem to be any logical argument coming from him, except for that he didn't feel it was right. It didn't feel right to him. And don't forget, this was from someone who said that they were able to leave their feelings at the door. After some time, one member of the team pointed out to this individual that in the new structure, his team was going to be significantly larger. He was going to have more budget and he was going to have a greater remit and more people. And I would say my recollection is that pretty suddenly this individual suddenly saw all the advantages of this option. Now, the story sticks in my mind because it was so dramatic and because we had been talking about feelings and this individual had made it very clear that he didn't believe that his feelings played any part in his decision making, when very clearly the reason that he didn't like the idea that was being posited was that he didn't like the way it felt, when clearly his emotions were really running the show. There was no logical reason to reject this outcome. The process had been really scientific. And it was only when this person's emotional needs were met, the need to have a nice big team, the need to have lots of resources, the need to have a bigger remit, then he suddenly saw all the advantages of this option. The funny thing is that in the industrial model where the machine is king, emotions are not generally talked about or acknowledged. And yet they are even more powerful because they are ignored. There's no outlet for them. People aren't allowed to express their feelings because it's not logical. When people are asked to critique something, they're asked to critique constructively, to say what they would do differently or what could be better. It's a logical argument. Sometimes we don't like something because we kind of don't like it. We don't like the way it makes us feel. We don't like the way we feel about it. But in the industrial model, that is not valid. So the irony is that the more we ignore emotions in the workplace, the more powerful they become. But what happens when, as a leader, you create space for emotion? What happens when you consciously check in with your feelings and use that to give you clues about what you think and how you perceive? Well, let's have a look at that a little bit now. For me, there are three parts of a picture. There is the information that you're receiving, the logical information, if you like. But you don't just see the logical information neutrally. You bring to it your perceptions, your beliefs. Nothing is neutral. It is affected by the way that you look at it, the lens through which you look at the information. So that's the second dimension. There's the first dimension of the information or the logic, and the second dimension of your perception or your beliefs. And then there's the third dimension of the feelings or emotions that you bring to this picture, to this opportunity, to this situation. So feelings are a vital part of how you gather information in order to make a decision. We may deny that emotion was the driver for our decision making, and we may claim that we made a decision purely on logic, but if logic was the only factor, we would all end up agreeing, wouldn't we? But we don't, because we see the world differently and we feel differently towards the information. When you take the conversation to an emotional level, or you allow emotions and feelings to be part of the conversation, you can really get to the guts of the matter. And I mean this literally. The intestine has about 40 neurotransmitters. There are about 100 in the brain, about 40 in the intestine. And the intestine produces 95% of the body's serotonin and half of the body's dopamine. How we feel is very much affected by what's going on in our body, in our stomach. Now, logical reasoning does happen in the brain, the one that's in our head. But increasingly, research scientists are finding so many connections between the brain that's in our head and the gut and our mood that the intestine is often referred to as the second brain. Feelings are a result of our thinking. They don't exist as something separate from our thinking. They're the response to the way we think and not the cause of our thinking. And this is a really important distinction, because sometimes we believe that we think a certain way because of how we feel about something. In actual fact, we feel a certain way about it because of how we think. Changing the thinking is required in order to change the way that we feel. That's why when someone says, "Oh, cheer up, you can't do it," unless you actually look at what the thinking is and how that is causing you to not feel completely cheerful. But when we have these feelings, they're a really powerful clue that offers us a way to explore our assumptions and our beliefs and our way of thinking and seeing. So feelings as they arise are like a little red flag that say, oh, something interesting is going on with my thinking. Let's have a look at that. So the first point that I wanted to make is that feelings and emotion form part of this triangle of how we gather our information, the other two parts being our perception or our beliefs and the logic, the sort of data that we're getting. The second important point about emotion that I want to make is that emotion, so far at least, can't be mechanized. Often I'm involved in conversations about whether there even will be any work for human beings in the future, because bots are becoming so intelligent that they're going to be able to do a lot of the work that human beings do today. And some people are very excited about that, and some people are very frightened about that, and you can feel both ways simultaneously, in fact. But certainly at the moment, with what we know about what these bots, these robots are capable of, I can't see that they're going to be able to empathize for a while. I can't see that they're going to be able to feel in the way that human beings feel for a pretty long time. So if we're wondering how to ensure that human beings have work in the future, then the safest bet is to focus on using people in the workplace to do what bots can't do. In other words, to use them when feelings and emotion are really important. So if we say there's no room for feelings in the workplace and that every decision can be made purely on the data, what we're actually saying is a robot could do my job. If, however, we acknowledge that feelings and emotion also influence our decision making, that that's a good thing because we're dealing with other human beings who have feelings and emotions, and unless we can really connect with them, unless we can really empathize, unless we can understand beyond a logical, data-driven level, we will not be able to satisfy the needs that they feel that they have. Unless we acknowledge that, then we're going to find the bots are going to take our jobs. But if we do acknowledge it, we're going to be able to create things and products and services and solutions that bots would not be able to conceive of. There's a huge amount of focus at the moment on STEM subjects in schools and universities. This is science, technology, engineering, and maths, because there is a recognition that technology and engineering are going to be critical, even more critical in the future, because of the sophistication of the machines that we are starting to make. However, the most successful tech companies in the world have a very high proportion of arts graduates working in their organizations. And I think that this is related to what I'm talking about, because the maths and the technology and the engineering is very important. We won't be able to invent anything without those things. But knowing what to invent, knowing how to make them user-friendly, knowing how to make them intuitive in the way that they're used, that comes down to being able to feel and sense. It comes down to emotion. And if we ignore that certain people in the organization are valuable because that's what they bring, then we're not going to be able to invent what our world needs us to invent. The third piece around emotion is that it's critical to trust. Trust is required to get stuff done. If you can't wield power in the way that you might have done in the past because you had a certain job title, then you need people to trust you. And as I talked about last week, levels of trust are at crisis point in our world. It's the responsibility of business as part of this four-legged stool of the government, media, NGOs and business to look at how it creates distrust in our world, in the people it touches, in its own employees, and how to mend that distrust. When we create intimate relationships in the workplace, so that special feeling that you have when you feel you can open up to someone, that's what I mean by intimacy, then you have the basis for trust. Now, intimacy, for intimacy to work, it is a two-way process that requires the other person opening up as well. So you may be willing to be open, the other person may not be. And so the trust still has some ways to go. But someone has to start, right? So you're the leader. You're the one who's going to disrupt the status quo. You're the one who sees what is and what could be and wants to make things different, wants to resolve that tension. So you can be the one that initiates this effort to create more intimacy. Now, intimacy is created by a number of activities: listening, being supportive, sharing aspects of your life with other people, putting your own needs aside sometimes to respond to the needs of others. And it is easier with some people than other people. So if you have colleagues who share the same values as you, or if they have a similar lifestyle to you, or if they've had the similar personal challenges to you, then it is easier to create intimacy. But you're going to need to create intimacy beyond those people that just automatically you feel a click with. In those situations where there isn't that obvious click, they may understand logically that you are good at your job, that you have technical expertise, that you have many years of experience. But if they don't feel this connection with you, if they don't feel they're seeing the real you, they'll kind of sit on the fence when it comes to their trust, with only logic to guide them. Everything you do is under scrutiny. If they agreed with the last thing you did, they probably trusted you a little bit more. But if they don't agree with the next thing you do, then they trust you a little bit less. When expertise or logic forms the basis of the relationship, that relationship's always under review. It's always conditional. But when the relationship moves beyond logic, because it's underpinned by an intimate relationship between two human beings, it's more robust. It might take longer to develop that kind of intimacy than just, you know, proving your worth by the last thing you did. But it also takes a lot more to break that relationship. And that's why I say that intimacy has a better tensile strength than logic. By the way, and I say this quite frequently when I talk about these kind of approaches to building relationships, developing intimacy is not a trick. It's not something that you do. It's not NLP. It's not techniques. It's not influencing skills. It's none of that learnt behavior that you paste on top of your undisturbed set of beliefs and assumptions. True intimacy is created when there is no agenda other than the desire to create intimacy. Intimacy is its own outcome. You're not generating intimacy so that someone will do what you want. You're not creating intimacy so that you can say something that you've been avoiding saying and you need to have intimacy in order to say it. You are simply creating intimacy. And that's why, if you're finding it hard to create intimacy, if you're struggling to invest the time that that kind of relationship requires, it isn't that you lack the skills. It's that there's something in your thinking that is stopping you from doing it. And that's where you need to start to ask yourself, why don't I want to? What's going on for me? What do I believe about this person? What do I believe about myself? Is my heart genuinely in the right place? Or am I trying to trick this other person into trusting me? And that is the work of leadership. It's those questions. There are a few reasons why emotion has a really valuable place in the organization. But how do you use it? In what circumstances do you use emotion? Because I'm not suggesting that everyone sits around and talks about how they're feeling all the time. And I'm not suggesting that you start talking to everyone about your emotional world. In any case, before you can even articulate how you feel to anyone else, do you actually know how you feel? There are a huge number of words to describe emotion, and yet we use very few of them in the workplace. People talk about passion, and they sometimes talk about fear. Occasionally, people will talk about disappointment, and that is about as broad a range of language that we use in the workplace. Oh, I forgot to say, sometimes people will say they're happy. And sometimes people will say they're fine. But that's about it. Now, human beings are very sensitive to emotions and to the subtlety of different emotions, even if we're not skilled at articulating those emotions. So what we tend to do is we tend to minimize how we feel. How are you? Oh yeah, I'm fine. Pretty good. Not bad. A little bit disappointed. A little bit worried. A little bit excited. I'm quite passionate. We tend to minimize how we feel. But if you Google emotion words, something like that, you will get lists of hundreds and hundreds of words. Things like agitated, discombobulated, one of my favorites. Actually, that is used quite a lot in business because other people like it too. Wary, suspicious, enthusiastic, cautiously optimistic. I'm not going to read you a whole list of words, but there is a huge range. And you know, there's something quite different about saying that you feel agitated versus saying something's not right today and not being able to say quite what you mean. You know, if someone asks you how you are and you say fine, when in actual fact you feel preoccupied, which is a fabulous word, there's very little chance that person can help you or listen to you well or really connect with you. When you say you're fine, they may or may not believe you're fine. I mean, they probably don't believe you're fine, but generally when people say they're fine, it's not the full answer. So people probably won't believe it. But when you say you're fine, you've also sent a message that says stay away. And this is not a strong foundation for trust or for connectedness. So not being able to articulate these emotions can lead to minimization of emotions and then a lack of connection. The other thing that can happen without a full vocabulary of emotion words is that you can easily fall into the opposite, into catastrophizing. So frequently I'll be told that a meeting was a disaster, that the person nearly died, and that the situation is hopeless. And I suspect they didn't nearly die, but what is the truth of it? When we give such dramatic language to our feelings, we actually convince ourselves, our brains respond as if we really live in the world of extremes. But how did this person actually feel? They didn't nearly die and it wasn't hopeless and it wasn't disastrous. How did they actually feel? Maybe after the meeting they felt empty or dissatisfied or unsure. And these are better starting points for self-reflection and for a discussion than it was a disaster, I'm hopeless. Very little can be learnt when one perceives a situation as disastrous. But when one feels empty after a meeting, that's really interesting. So in practice, there are a few different situations where starting to bring emotion into the conversation, or certainly reflecting on your own emotions and how that's impacting your behaviour and what that's telling you about your thinking, can be really useful. The first situation is when you're getting to know someone or when they're getting to know you. Now, I've worked with teams who've been together for many years and been colleagues for decades in some cases, and there are basic things that they don't know about each other. The best opportunity for building strong bonds is when you first meet someone. We tend to make a lot of assumptions about people, even before we've met them. Someone new is coming into the business. We've already got a picture in our mind about what they're going to be like and what they're going to do when they get here. But when we open ourselves up to having conversations that are, yes, about facts and data. Oh, so where did you work before and how many years have you been in this industry? But when we open up to other kinds of information, then we are able to build a proper 3D version of that person. Now, for me, I would always start with myself. I would always start that conversation of building these bonds with revealing how I feel about certain things. I might be relatively cautious. I mean, no one wants to know my opinions about everything, although if you're listening to this, maybe you are quite curious about my opinions about things. So I would always be a little cautious. I'd always recognise that this is the workplace, but I wouldn't actively avoid sharing how I feel about certain situations with someone, because to me, that takes the conversation to a deeper level and makes it possible for them to talk about how they feel about things. Now, you can create exercises for doing this. Sometimes in a workshop we'll do this, where we ask people to bring in an object from home and talk about why that object is important to them. And this starts to create bonds, and it reveals something about themselves that is more than just data and facts, but allows you to access more of the emotion, more of the stuff that's going on in the heart and in the gut. The second time to think about the part that emotion is playing is when tensions arise. Very often those are the situations where we become very logical about things, or where we try to put the logical argument. But as we've already seen, logic plays only a very small part in why we're responding the way that we're responding. Our feelings are playing a big part as well. So starting to reflect on, why do I feel the way I feel? Why am I resistant to this idea? Why am I fighting it? Why do I feel so strongly against it or so strongly for it? Why have I become defensive? What is it that I'm feeling is the first question. And then what are the thoughts that I'm having that are creating those feelings? And a great place to go for more on this is Byron Katie. I've mentioned her before, but I would say that her Judge Your Neighbor worksheet is the perfect tool to use if you want to explore the connection between thinking and feeling when tensions arise. Thirdly, you can bring emotions into meetings in check-ins. So in many self-managing organizations, holacracies, and other types of self-managing systems, a meeting will begin with a check-in round where people share how they are. They talk about anything that's going on for them that might be getting in the way of them being fully present in this meeting. Now, for some people, there'll be nothing. They feel great. They're here. They're excited to get on with it. They've been looking forward to the meeting. For other people, there is something going on and they share it. Maybe they are worried about the sick kid that they've got, that they've left behind at home today with the nanny. Maybe they are still angry about what happened in the meeting that they've just come from. Maybe they are distracted because there's a project that they've been working on today and they've been kind of disrupted from that project by this meeting and they can't wait to get back to it. What's really important is that there's no analysis of these feelings. No one says anything, in fact, in response to a person's check-in. So if I were to say, yeah, I'm feeling a little annoyed that I have to be here because I was working on something very important and you know, now I'm disrupted, no one says, oh yeah, that's a shame, or no one tries to get me out of the funk that I'm in. It's just out there in the space. And that appears to be enough in many cases. That might be that at some future point, someone wants to pick up with me on something that I said. But in actual fact, all we're doing is acknowledging that we are human beings around the room and that everyone is in a different frame of mind. And just by articulating it, it's kind of job done. As we saw from the example earlier on in this podcast about the member of the team who was resistant to the new structure, the emotion's there anyway. Ignoring it, pretending that it's not there, denying that you bring emotion into a situation is really disruptive to the health of a team and the health of an organization. Just identifying that there is emotion around and that people are feeling different ways to each other is usually enough. And the final situation that I want to suggest you could talk about emotion is when logic isn't working. We still live in a world that is pretty obsessed with logic and data, and where the decisions that you make are meant to be scientifically arrived upon. But sometimes logic just isn't working. When you want to lead on an initiative, you have an idea, you want to make a difference, and you want other people to come with you and join with you to make this difference, you may start talking about it and trying to convince them to be part of it. And you may use a lot of very clear logic about why this is important, why it's going to succeed, why you need them. But some people won't agree with you. And in order to come with you, they will need to change their mind. And if you want someone to change their mind, logic is not going to be enough because they have logic of their own. And the way that they see things is different to the way that you see things. And it doesn't matter how much logic you throw at them, the way that they receive that information, the lens through which they view it, is different to the lens through which you view it. And you are very unlikely ever to see each other's point of view. However, when you make the conversation more about feelings, how do you feel about this situation? How do you feel about this proposal? And when you reflect on the feelings that you have about it and also about them and their response to it, then you have a much richer picture. And as I said, feelings are a response to thinking, but they offer us really good ways to access our thinking. So for yourself, you have this brilliant idea, you think it's going to make millions of pounds for your organization, and you are really afraid that if people don't buy into it, then the business is going to miss out on this massive opportunity, and maybe this is going to be really serious for the business in future. So yes, you're excited about the opportunity, but you also are quite motivated by fear of the consequences of not implementing your initiative. Acknowledging that fear is a part of it rather than just the enthusiasm and the passion can help to position your conversations differently. You're afraid. What is the other person afraid of? How do they see things that means that they don't have the same fears as you, or they don't believe that the same solutions are required? And this is a much richer, much deeper conversation, which actually is more likely to develop trust, even if the two of you continue to disagree about the logic. Now, I said this at the beginning, but please don't rush off after this podcast and ask everybody to start talking about their feelings. They will think you are a nutter and it will not be successful. Instead, reflect on your own. How do you feel today? What impact is that having on you? How is it influencing your connectedness with yourself and with other people? Does awareness of these feelings bring you peace? Or do you need to do something in order to find peace? Feelings are not truth. They're based on perception. So what are you perceiving? How are you perceiving the situation? And how might that be causing you this problem in the way that you're feeling? Would becoming curious about the source of these feelings and the thinking that sits behind them be better than the assumptions that you're making and the way that you're feeling right now? The topic of emotion and intimacy is a big one, and there are plenty of other resources available if you are curious. So there will be a big chapter about it in my book, but that's not out yet. So for now, I would suggest Daniel Goleman, the granddaddy of emotional intelligence. He's written a number of books about EI, and any of them will give you some really good insights and some really good provocative thinking to get you going on this topic of emotion and feelings. Byron Katie, I've already mentioned, and a really good book called Clarity by Jamie Smart. I admit I haven't read the whole book. I got about halfway through and felt like, yeah, I got the idea. But I refer very often back to some of the things that I got from the first half of his book. So I suggest you read the first half of it too. That's it for this week. Don't forget that I am speaking at the Agile Working Conference on the 29th of March in London. This is one of the very few opportunities for just members of the public to come and see me. Normally when I'm speaking at a conference, an industry conference or a company conference that you'd only be able to attend if you were part of that industry or if you were part of that business. This is one that you can come to just as an independent individual. There is a special offer price if you contact the organisers and mention me, and I will hand over now to Ivy Palmer to tell you more about how you can access that special offer price.
If to attend the Agile Working event in London on March 29th, 2017, we are able to offer a special price of £249 plus VAT, a saving of £150. This price is available to listeners of the Punks and Suits podcast, and all you need to do is send an email to contact@agileworkingevent.com with the words Agile Working Event BP17 in the subject line. Tell them how many tickets you need and how to contact you, and you will be able to get the special price even when the early bird price has finished at the end of January. For more information about the event, go to www.agileworkingevent.com. Please stay in touch with us on Twitter, Instagram and email. And remember to share this podcast with as many Punks and Suits as you know.